What's an economy for anyway? Today we'll be talking about this question with Professors Nancy Fulbright and Jim Boyce. They both teach in the Economics Department at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. Nancy Fulbright's work has focused on feminist theory and the political economy, with a particular interest in caring labor and other forms of non-market work. She's written several books on the subject, including The Invisible Heart, Economics and Family Values, and her most recent book, which she co-authored with James Heinz, The Ultimate Field Guide to the U.S. Economy. Jim Boyce examines the economics of environmental and natural resources. He directs the UMass Political Economy Research Institute's program on development, peacebuilding, and the environment. Recently, Nancy and Jim have gathered together with a group to write a grant proposal for a campaign that they hope will get people to begin asking the question, what is an economy for anyway? Let's start by talking about where this idea began, this, to start questioning or to start shifting the question to what's the economy for anyway?
What brought us together was an effort to think about social wealth in all of its forms and how to create a kind of a coalition of thinkers and activists around it. And I think one of the things we had in common was a sense that the priorities of our economic accounting system are really misplaced, and that none of these forms of wealth are really accounted for. And as a result, they often get kind of devalued, depreciated, ignored.
Right.
And so, you know, what's the economy for anyway was kind of a way of getting people's attention to the netherworld, you know, the stuff that's left out, the stuff for which GDP or gross domestic product should be, should be a means of making ourselves healthier and happier and not an end in and of itself.
So tell me about what some of those things are that aren't measured by the gross domestic product.
Well, you can take the environment as an example. And in a way, going back to your first question, Deb, if you think about how environmental problems are often posed in politics, in the press, and so on, it's presented as if there's a sort of an inexorable trade-off between growing the economy and making people better off in economic terms versus protecting the environment. And so that this comes out as a jobs versus environment trade-off and so on. And it seems to me that there are two levels at which that notion of a trade-off between economic well-being and environmental well-being can be attacked. The level that it's usually attacked at is to say that, well, if you look at what happens when you try to protect the environment, it actually creates jobs. It can be a very employment-generating type of activity. There's no necessary reason why, by changing production to make it cleaner, you somehow reduce the amount of labor that's needed in the economy. So that's one level, and there's a lot of work by economists and others that tries to look into that. But on another level, one can ask the question that we're starting to ask about this, which is, what's the economy for anyway? Is the aim of the economy just to produce a larger and larger pie as measured by the sum total of market goods and services? That's what gross domestic product really is. Is that what it's for? Or is it for making people, ordinary people, healthier and happier over the long run? Is it for the greatest good of the greatest number in the long run? And when you look at it that way, you realize that there's a lot of things that are important for people's health and happiness over the long run that aren't counted in the market basket of goods and services. All the things that, you know, the air we breathe, the water we drink, a lot of really important things aren't counted. There have been a few efforts to try to put numbers on these things. I was thinking as I was walking over to the studio, this afternoon. About a decade ago, a group of economists and ecologists got together, and they tried to do something which is either heroic or kind of crazy, depending on how you look at it, which is put a price tag on the world's supply of ecosystem services. So if you think about ecosystems as purifying water and maintaining a flow of natural resources, you know, trees, fish, everything. And they tried to say, well, let's add that up and see how all of those free ecosystem services that aren't counted in by the market compare to market activity. And the number they came up with, I mean, one can dispute these numbers, of course, was $33 trillion a year, which at that time was about almost twice as much as the world's total gross domestic product of all the countries of the world added together. So these uncounted ecosystem services were twice as big as the economy as traditionally measured. Now, no one would go to the mat over $33 trillion as the right number. In fact, one economist subsequently wrote, this is a serious underestimate of infinity, because after all, without these ecosystem services, none of us would even exist. But the point is that there's a lot going on out there that really matters, that really counts. And to focus only on a narrow vision of the economy without asking the question, what are we actually trying to do here? What is this economy for? Means that you're asking the wrong question. And as Thomas Pynchon once said, if you get people asking the wrong question, you've already lost. What's the quote, Nancy? I can't remember. You've already lost the game, basically.
So you're really fundamentally trying to shift the conversation when it comes to the economy and what its service is, what it's about, what it's for.
Yeah, we really want to turn it around. So, you know, people turn on the evening news and they hear all these reports about what happened to the Dow Jones or the Standard & Poor's Industrial Index or the, you know, the NASDAQ. What are those except sort of a means to a larger end? We ought to be hearing more about what's happening to people's leisure time and their health and their ability to get outside and ride their bikes, and I don't know, just a lot of other, there are a lot of other things that, a lot of other indicators of our collective well-being that we should be paying more attention to.
Right. I know that when I see, you know, sometimes the stock market went way up and I'm thinking,
who cares?
Well, I still don't have health insurance and, you know, I'm still working too much and, you know, right. It doesn't seem to jive with most of our life experience.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. It's not that it's unimportant. I do think it's, I'm not opposed to reporting it, but it's just that it sort of seems to have gotten kind of fetishized as the only indicator of our economic well-being, and it's really misleading.
Mm-hmm. So what is the question that we should be asking? What is the economy for?
Well, I would say, I mean, Jim and I have kind of a division of labor where he knows more about environmental issues and the natural environment, and my work is mostly about family work and community work. And one of the great things about the project has been our ability to learn from each other and kind of cross-fertilize our areas of research. But I guess the way I would answer your question would be that there's now a lot of evidence that money is not a very good determinant of happiness. Most people need a certain amount to meet their basic needs, but once they get past that amount, the factors that are more likely to determine their sense of well-being are whether they have a good family life, whether they have friends they can rely on, whether they live in a community that they feel is supportive of their needs. And I think we just need to figure out ways to call attention to those less tangible aspects of human well-being.
And I think the aim of doing that is not only to appreciate more things that tend to be neglected, but also to think about what that appreciation implies for the kinds of policies, including public policies, that we want to advocate for in our country. I mean, policies to some extent reflect what people want or what they're kind of taught to want. And so if you think about the sorts of economic policies that have been driven by this, as Nancy said, fetishistic focus on marketed goods and services, on bigger and bigger GDP, I think, several things that are problematic with it. First, all the things it leaves out, and indeed some of the things it counts. I mean, if you spend more money on prisons or military matters or cleaning up pollution. I mean, I'm not saying that money shouldn't be spent on, to some extent, on these things, but these are all things that are kind of expenses that you regret having to undertake, and you make these, you incur these expenses because something went wrong, because people ended up in jail, or you ended up in wars, or you damaged the environment, and now you have to spend money to fix it up. That all counts as a good thing. That's expanding GNP, right? So you don't count things that really do matter. You do count things that are regrettable, that partly you have to deal with because you weren't counting the things that did matter. And so the policies need to be rethought to take take this bigger picture into account and think about how we ought to be investing our resources in ways that really are going to achieve the greatest good, the biggest sum total of human well-being. You can think of it as that one. That is as one measure of the greatest good. You can also think about the greatest good for the greatest number. You can think about how the pie in terms of human well-being is distributed. The focus on a bigger and bigger economic pie measured in dollars and cents has gone hand in hand with a downplaying of the importance of thinking about how that pie is distributed across society. So the growth first kind of policies that really ramped up, I would say, starting about three decades ago. I trace it back to the Nixon years, although one can dispute when exactly to start it, has gone along with a set of cutbacks in the provision of a lot of social safety net type services in the country. A kind of a rollback of the New Deal in certain ways has been underway. Comes before the Bush-Cheney regime, our current government. That has been lauded on the grounds that the size of the pie is growing. In fact, the rationale for it is this will make a bigger pie. But what that bigger pie involves is more and more money being accumulated, more and more income and wealth being accumulated at the top, while at the bottom, people are working harder and harder. They have less and less time. They're running faster just to stay in place, basically.
It's not trickling down.
So a part of rethinking what's the economy for involves not only thinking, you know, what counts and what doesn't, but also if you're talking about human well-being as the ultimate goal, then you have to talk about all humans, not just, you know, the fact that somebody else is adding another $1 billion at the top doesn't do anything for human well-being if people on the bottom are getting worse off as a result. And then the other piece of it is thinking about the long run, thinking about this over time, thinking not only about the people who are here today, but also our children and our children's children, and the implications of the policies we have today for what their lives are going to be like.
I think I could add in a couple of interesting examples from healthcare. If you look at, the conventional economic analysis of the healthcare industry, things like nursing homes, hospitals, that are now increasingly dominated by for-profit firms with a lot of incentives to try to cut costs, their productivity and their success is measured by indicators like how quickly they get people through the door, how efficiently they can get somebody in a, you know, after a difficult operation, get them to the point where they can go home. But a lot of those improvements in productivity in hospitals and nursing homes have been achieved by increasing the demands on family members and community members to help care for people who now are often, you know, undergoing outpatient treatment or making a transition to being at home without very much assistance. And, you know, those are resources. That takes time, it takes energy, and People who don't have paid family leaves from work, people who don't have vacation time, families are often really find it very difficult to meet those needs. And yet, you know, if you make an argument for paid family leave, you'll often hear the objection, oh, well, that would lower economic growth. You know, that would hurt our standard of living. Well, it's as though they think that the time that people take away from work is all sitting in front of a TV or just kind of wasting resources. But in fact, people have a lot of productive things that they do with their time that is not actually paid work.
Yeah. I was just talking about that with a friend yesterday at a coffee shop as we discussed that I was going to speak with you two. And we were saying we spend so many hours a day not at work. But we're not sitting around watching TV and eating candy. We're, you know, helping his elderly father, working on projects that I think will help the community. I mean, we don't just sit around, but none of that is measured in any way. Yeah.
And let me put in, I mean, I think it's really important to recognize that there's a lot of unpaid work that doesn't get counted in the home, in the community, and that's one of the things people do with their time if they're not running like crazy just to keep their income from declining. But let me put in a good word for sitting around, too. Sitting around is not a bad thing to do some of, you know. It's people need to sit around, including sit in front of the TV. I wish there were better things to watch. But the point is that that leisure, you know, you don't have to be productive in order to justify how you've spent your last hour or your evening or your day, you know. Right. I mean, people need that time. And it's people need time to spend together, hanging out. It's part of what makes life worth living.
Right.
And it's sort of an irony that in this, the ostensibly richest country in the world and richest country in human history, et cetera, that people are running around like crazy with less time than they ever had before. Yep. I mean, so again, you ask yourself, well, what's the economy for anyway? Mm-hmm. I mean, what are we doing all this for if we don't have time to enjoy it? It really makes you think. At least we think it ought to make you think.
Yeah. So if we're using that definition of the greatest good for the greatest amount of people, would you be able to articulate what your potential opponents or somebody who didn't agree with this might say? Like, how could you disagree with that? I know there are people. There are a lot of people who might.
Well, I think maybe... I think what people have pointed to in the past, which is a good point, is it's difficult to define the greatest good and that people often have different definitions of the good. And, you know, one of the reasons it's so easy to evoke ideals of individual choice and individual freedom is precisely because, you know, people do disagree about what is good for them. And I think that... there's something to be said for appreciation of individual differences, but what it ignores is the many things that we can't, you know, that we lose the freedom to take advantage of if we don't make some social decisions about what to protect and what to defend and what to value. And, you know, the three forms of social wealth that we really emphasize are all things that you can't, individuals just can't get them on their own. They're a product. They can only be established and defended and protected by some kinds of collective efforts that enable us to coordinate what we're doing. And, you know, that's what democracy is supposed to be about, is about, you know, making decisions to expand our commonwealth. And I think that it's that aspect of democracy that keeps getting stripped away and kind of... by too much emphasis on purely individual decisions and choices.
What were the three? You referred to the three
areas of social wealth. Yes. Well, the natural wealth, the environment, social wealth, families and communities, and the wealth of human knowledge and technology. Those are the three things that we think you can't really put a price tag on, and you can't just buy a little piece of them. They're complicated and very interactive. Forms of social wealth that are really just much larger and more important than the kind of measures of financial wealth or private wealth that we tend to focus on more closely.
Mm-hmm. I know in your campaign proposal that I read about your efforts towards doing something with this concept, you talk a lot about, or you refer to, Europeans and how they've moved in a different direction than we have. Can you just talk a little bit, I know it's a probably a huge topic, but a little about when we diverged from them, maybe it was that 30 or so years ago, what they're doing differently in terms of social wealth and honoring that more than we are?
Well, I think broadly, if you look at how Europe and the states diverged in terms of their policies, their public policies, starting roughly 30 or 35 years ago, at a time when the U.S. began to focus more on what I would call running faster to stay in place, letting inequality rise, moving from a situation where the inequality in the distribution of individual wealth in this country was roughly average for the industrialized countries to a position where now it's the most unequal of any of the industrialized countries. When we moved in that direction, Europe, I think, continued to maintain and in some respects deepen its policy commitments to a more egalitarian set of policies, more shared wealth, less concentration on individual greed, really, as a driving force for society. And so one can kind of look back now. It's been a long time. It's been a generation, more than a generation, see what the fruits of this were. And how it looks depends partly, again, by how you measure success. If you measure success just in terms of growing the marketed bundle of goods and services, if you measure it in terms of GDP, the U.S. economy's been, on the whole, growing faster. So, you know, people who think that that's all the economy's about point to it and say, see, the U.S. policies work better. The Europeans ought to be more like the United States. They're lagging behind, right? But if you look at things through a slightly different lens, it looks quite different. So, in terms of even the marketed aspect of the economy, the bundle of goods and services. If you look at productivity per hour as a measure, Europe's closed the gap with the United States, right? Mm. It's gone up in Europe, right? And yet their total output is still, you know, per person roughly, let's say, 70% of the United States. Now, how is it that they're producing as much per hour, but the total output is 70% as much? Well, they're only working 70% as much as we do. They don't put in as many hours. They have longer vacations, shorter work weeks, fewer people participating in the labor force, et cetera, right? So in a way, what Europe's done is it's improved its productivity and taken the profits from that in the form of time, in the form of more leisure, whereas we haven't done that. We've grown the size of the pie, distributed it inequitably on the grounds that in the end this is somehow good for everybody, whereas, and you know, talk to normal people and they'll tell you that somehow it hasn't reached me yet. And so then you say, well, okay, that's a difference, but you know, how does that translate into human well-being? Well, if you look at health, for example, you know, how healthy people are, how long they live, how healthy they are while they're alive, Europe has moved way ahead of the United States, and that's not only because most European countries have a national healthcare system that doesn't leave anybody out so that, you know, everybody can get healthcare if they need it, but it's also because there's just less stress, less of all the kinds of ills that underpin ill health in our society today. And so I think it's an interesting comparison to look at. I don't mean to gloss over problems in Europe. I'm not saying it's paradise and everything there is great, but it's just like, here's some basic differences. We can see how two roads diverged and ask which one really turned out to be the better road. Well, it depends on your answer to the question, what's the economy for anyway?
So are economists beginning to create tools that can estimate the value of this non-market work that we're talking about?
In my area, I can see some really important new tools. The Bureau of Labor Statistics now administers an annual survey called the American Time Use Survey that asks a representative sample of Americans how they spent their time. Basically, what time did you wake up yesterday? What did you do? What did you do then? You know, where were you? Who was with you? And so it's possible to identify how much time we spent caring for children, caring for household adults, how much time was spent commuting back and forth to work, how much time was spent, you know, preparing meals, how much was time spent
caring for sick or elderly, like you were saying.
And so that's a data set that I do a lot of work with, and a lot of people have been attracted to it as a new potential set of insights into mm-hmm. the whole non-market mm-hmm. economy.
I'm curious what, with the fact that you're both professors, what the reaction to these kind of ideas are in younger, in the emerging adults. What are they thinking about this?
Actually, I think there's evidence of a generational change. I know I was fascinated by a recent article in Business Week talking about the difficulty that corporations have recruiting young workers if they are engaged in what might be called a socially reprehensible industry, and that corporations that have kind of a vision of doing the right thing by their consumers and their workers and trying to be socially responsible companies actually find it easier to attract top talent. I think that's a very interesting possibility. I wouldn't want to overstate it, but the idea that workers, highly educated workers, are going to be picky enough to punish corporations who are engaged in socially irresponsible behavior is a really great prospect. Mm-hmm. And I know there's been some discussion of kind of the 9/11 generation of young people who have grown up in a world where, earning money doesn't seem quite to have quite as much of the gloss and thrill that it mm-hmm. might have. It just seems like we're living in a world with a lot of really pressing social problems, and I think the younger generation is going to rise to that. Particularly conspicuous features of that challenge are going to bring out the best in them. I have a lot of faith in my students. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think there's a learning experience. I don't think it's just the younger generation that's figured this out. I think middle-aged people, at all age groups, the experience is accumulating, and people are looking at what the consequences have been of the economic policies and other policies with respect to vacation, paid leave, child care, health care, environmental policy, patent policy on flows of information, all this stuff. And the verdict is kind of gradually becoming clearer in people's minds. And the verdict is, this isn't working out quite as well as its proponents said it would. And we need to rethink. We need to think about how we could do things differently. So I think, a lot of workers, they're not only concerned with the money they get for their jobs. Obviously, that's a big concern, but they're concerned about healthcare. They're concerned about having time to spend with their family, and they're concerned about feeling good about the work they do. I remember hearing a story from a good friend of Nancy's and mine's a few years ago about the campaign to get Home Depot to carry wood that was certified by the Forest Stewardship Council, which was a big campaign. Greenpeace, Rainforest Action Network, and others were involved in trying to get Home Depot to preferentially stock lumber products that had been produced in an environmentally and socially responsible manner that's certified by this group called FSC, which now certifies about 10% of the working forest lands in the world. And when Home Depot finally decided to do this, to the stockholders voted for it to happen and so on, and it was announced to the employees, I'm told they stood up and cheered.
Wow.
Why is that, right? Because they actually care about what they're doing. They want to feel good about what they're selling or what they're producing. And that's an important resource for policy to draw on, is people's goodwill. I think most people have basic goodwill, good instincts, good moral values, and that's a strength we ought to be playing to, as opposed to corroding it by appeals to greed.
Right. So in this, your hope for this potential, this campaign that you're putting out here, what would you like to see happen? Where would you like to see it lead to, ideally? Go for it, your biggest dreams.
I think, basically we're just our goals are pretty modest. We want people to start a systematic conversation. We'd like to see kind of a grassroots effort to think more critically and more creatively about the way we organize our economic lives. And I think that could, you know, that could build into something larger in a variety of ways. I think we'd like to see it affect election campaigns. I think that it could help hold political candidates more accountable for the kinds of policies that we're promoting. I'd like to see it affect creative thinkers and artists be, you know, to get more interested in economic issues and find a way of widening the debate in that way. Like to change what, you know, what people do at work, in their workplace, the way their willingness to engage with their employers and their fellow workers about what's going on. There are a lot of very direct ways that people can address those issues. But we don't have like one single goal that we want everybody to get up and do all at once. Mm-hmm. We just think we want to hear the voices rise. You know, we want to hear a chorus of concern around the economy.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for joining us today. Yeah, Thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
Okay, good luck.
It's been a pleasure.
I'd like to thank our guests, Nancy Fulbright and Jim Boyce. Thanks for joining us for It's About Time. We welcome your comments and story ideas. You can email them to itsabouttimeradio@comcast.net. This show has been produced in association with Take Back Your Time, a national initiative challenging overwork, overscheduling, and time urgency. Find them at timeday.org.